Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. WITF's election 2020 coverage on Smart Talk continues today. We're joined by Pennsylvania's Democratic incumbent treasurer, Joe Torsella. The Pennsylvania Office of the State Treasurer serves as the custodian of more than $100 billion in Commonwealth funds and is responsible for the receipt and deposit of state monies, investment management, and oversight of all withdrawals and deposits from state agencies. Also running for treasurer are Republican Stacey Garrity, who will be on Smart Talk Wednesday, Green Party candidate Tim Runkle appeared earlier this month, and Libertarian Joe Soloski, who has not responded to our invitation. Treasurer Joe Torsella, welcome to the program.
Scott, always good to be with you, and thank you for your work in these unusual ways in these challenging times.
It is a challenge out there today, Mr. Treasurer. So why did you decide to run again?
Well, Scott, you know, 4 years ago, I said I wanted to do three things. I wanted to bring integrity, accountability, and transparency back to an office where three of the last five treasurers faced, elected treasurers faced the federal charges for corruption. I said I wanted to be a good fiscal watchdog, and I said I wanted to use the office's powers to help Pennsylvanians get ahead economically. And we've made a good start on all that. We've had some huge victories. But particularly in light of what the pandemic has done to Pennsylvania and to Pennsylvania's families, there is so much more ahead for us to do. We succeeded. On my first day in office, I banned the crazy practice of middlemen, which was responsible for so many of the corruption scandals we've seen. I appointed the first ever chief integrity officer, but the work of restoring people's trust in government is never ending. And we've made real progress on transparency, where we now have won national and international awards, but want to continue to do more if the legislature will give me some more powers. And I particularly want to continue, you know, we did something really innovative on my watch, and that's to create a program whereby every kid born in Pennsylvania or adopted gets at birth a 529 account with a $100 deposit, making us the first large state in the country to do that. I mean, that's making a dent in the affordability of higher education, but there's so much more around folks' economic security that we have good common sense plans for that I think we can get done in a second term.
I want to talk about your accomplishments, or what you see as your accomplishments in that first term, but something you just said about how the COVID-19 pandemic has changed so much here in Pennsylvania. How has it changed what you do as treasurer of Pennsylvania?
Sure. For starters, like most of the rest of Pennsylvania, what we do, and I want to tip my hat to the 300-plus men and women of Treasury who are extraordinary public servants, what they do now is mostly, like many in Pennsylvania, work remotely without missing a beat, you know, without a call center being closed, without people being able to get their payments or have their questions answered. But over the last 8 months plus, we have, in addition to filling the normal functions of Treasury, the unclaimed property, the 529s, the ABLE accounts for disabled Pennsylvanians, the plans we have for creating portable retirement accounts for people, we've sort of done a double shift and said, what can we do to help Pennsylvania get through this crisis? So early on, we extended a $2 billion emergency line of credit to the Commonwealth to the end of the then fiscal year. We found a creative way to get more than $500 million out to hospitals when they were on the brink for short-term liquidity purposes. We accelerated the processing of rent rebate checks, getting hundreds of millions of dollars into Pennsylvania families' hands months before it would have otherwise gotten there. I used the convening power of my office as treasurer to say to the largest banks in Pennsylvania, indeed the largest banks in the country, that they should cash Pennsylvanians' stimulus checks fee-free. They agreed to do that, saving tens of millions of dollars to Pennsylvanians. And I'll tell you the thing I'm most proudest that I'm proudest of, and that is we used the shares that I'm the custodian of, the Commonwealth, two words of our one word, Commonwealth, to stand up for Pennsylvanians in really meaningful ways. So when we had a ventilator shortage early in this crisis, I led a bipartisan coalition of treasurers that said to ventilator companies, we need you to let hospitals repair your equipment instead of retaining the rights to do that for your own profit and delaying the reentering into service of these machines. And to their credit, most of the large ventilator companies agreed to do that. We're now in a similar coalition around the pricing of remdesivir, which is the only approved treatment for COVID-19. but which has been priced by the manufacturer, Gilead, at more than 500 times the cost of its manufacturer. And this is for a drug that existed before this crisis and which taxpayers, including Pennsylvania taxpayers, paid to help develop. So I'm very proud of how we've used the office to stand up for Pennsylvanians in the middle of all this, in addition to coming through for them in all the unsung ways that keep the wheels of government turning at a time when people desperately need that, at a time when Pennsylvanians are hurting like never before.
I'm curious, the remdesivir pricing, how can Pennsylvania's treasurer, any treasurer for that matter, have an impact on the price of medication?
Sure. So, you know, one of my signal accomplishments, thing I talked to you about, you know, before I even entered this office, was I believe the way we were doing investing in Pennsylvania was all wrong. It was we were paying Wall Street managers who came in with misleading and unfulfillable promises to, quote, beat the market and charged hundreds of millions in fees to do that. I've shifted how we invest in Pennsylvania to index investing, which most Pennsylvanians know the wisdom of because it was invented right here in Pennsylvania. We've now saved $700 million for taxpayers by saying goodbye to high-priced, overpriced Wall Street managers and hello to plain Jane low-cost index funds. But with indexing comes both an obligation and an opportunity, because once you say, you know, we're investors who are going to own the market, you're then saying you're not going to sell a share of a company that you're unhappy with, even when it's hurting the people in your state. So as companies like Vanguard, BlackRock, and others have realized, when you're an index investor, you actually need to be an engaged shareholder. So Pennsylvanians own collectively shares in virtually every public company out there. And we use those shares, not always, not everywhere, but when we think their Pennsylvania's interests are being harmed, I use those, the power of those shares, to stand up for my constituents, for the 13 million of us. When we own shares in the company that's producing this drug, when we as taxpayers helped fund $70 million of its development, and when we see studies saying that it's priced more than 500 times the cost of its manufacturer in a crisis where, Scott, virtually everyone in every corner of the state and country is stepping forward to sacrifice a little bit, well, it got my dander up, and not just mine, it got up the Republican treasurer of our neighbor in Ohio joined me in leading a coalition that spans from Texas to Colorado, all kinds of politics and geographies, to say, yeah, we're public shareholders, and we don't think this is right. And that's exactly what we did in the ventilator case, and it worked. I hope it's going to work here, too, because so many Pennsylvanians, I mean, there are now, I think, nearly 8,500 families in Pennsylvania who are missing a loved one. So many more who have faced this disease. So many more who are scared of facing it. And not one of them should be denied this treatment because it's priced so unaffordably. So, you know, the answer to your question, and you've seen this, we've talked about some of these cases, you know, where we used our shares to, when Donald Trump took us out of the Paris Climate Accord, we used our shares to say, when it comes to Pennsylvania, we're still in, when we still care about this issue. We've used our shares to stand up to the opioid companies that have put their profits ahead of our safety for too long and won some major governance reforms at two of those companies. When Facebook, which has such a disproportionate influence on the market, you know, tries to keep all power in one combined chairman CEO, we've used our shares to make our voice heard there. And we're going to continue to do that, and if I'm given the privilege of another 4 years, I'm going to continue to do that on these issues that really affect Pennsylvanians in profound ways. That is, I say, both the obligation when you're an indexer, but it's also the opportunity. That is, as I said, our commonwealth, and part of what I am really happy about what I've done in office to help build Pennsylvanians' future with the Keystone accounts, with what we hope to do on retirement, what we've done on savings for disabled Pennsylvanians, but part of my job is to stand up when Pennsylvanians are being hurt by their own money, and to say, no, we won't let you get away with that. The final point I'll make here is, you know, we did something we haven't done in decades on my watch, and that is we were the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit where evidence was brought to us that 16 of the largest Wall Street banks were conspiring to fix prices of government bonds that Pennsylvania taxpayers bought. And indeed, the evidence was correct. Indeed, a cooperating witness stepped forward. And in record time, We got those banks to agree to pay nearly $400 million and to give Pennsylvania Treasury a role in monitoring their ongoing behavior. So I'm going to continue to use this office to the fullest to protect Pennsylvanians and to help them rebuild their future, especially in these enormously challenging times.
All right, so let's talk about a second term. What would your priorities be if you were reelected?
Sure, and as I said, you know, COVID has changed things. COVID has, I think in some ways, I'm told medically that what COVID does is sort of attack a person's weakest system and reveals what underlying conditions may be there. In some ways, COVID has done the same thing here to us in Pennsylvania, which is it's revealed our vulnerabilities. And at the state level, it reveals something I've talked about for all of my term as treasurer, and that's how unprepared we have been to have the reserves we need to weather the normal economic crises. The governor and legislature, to their credit, and I like to think in part due to my urging, made a deposit into the rainy day fund, $300 million, and that was historic and a first. But that funds one third of a day of government operations. So what COVID has shown us is that I need to continue to lead that charge to help us rebuild at the state level the capacity. And this is let's be clear, this is a historic, unusual, not our fault downturn, but we need to be better prepared for wherever the next downturn comes from. But at the family level, what we've seen is that the vulnerabilities that you and I have talked about over the years, of the cost of higher education, the need of something past high school, not necessarily 4 years of a liberal arts degree, but some sort of training, some certificate to compete in the 21st century economy. As that becomes more affordable, more Pennsylvanians are being left behind. The vulnerability of retirement security in a state where we have 2 million people who have no way of saving for retirement but are working. All those things, those are exactly the issues that have been revealed by what we've been through over the last many months, that higher education that was unaffordable nearly a year ago is now, that is the price of reentry for so many Pennsylvanians whose jobs have irrevocably changed. That retirement security that was just beyond their grasp, now those folks don't ever see a time when they can retire. So I'm going to double down on those things as well. And the first of them is something that I hoped we would get across the finish line before. Now we didn't. And then it got caught up in everyone's attention diverting to COVID. But I think we ought to do it now and as soon as possible in a second term if I get one. And that's retirement security for 2 million Pennsylvanians. We have talked about the fact that there are this many people who don't have a way of saving for retirement where they work. We've come up with a common sense, common grand solution, a portable IRA account, much like a 529 that would follow them from job to job and would simply make it easy for them to save their own money. And I want to get that across the finish line to both give those folks the future they deserve and, by the way, to relieve what we estimate to be nearly $1 billion a year in annual cost to the general fund. So going to both of our problems, the problem we have at the state level and the problem we have for the families who live in the state. Second thing I want to do is, we've taken a few swings at higher education, but I want to take a bigger one. Through the 529 program and the Keystone program, we've seen the depths of the chasm between what Pennsylvanians need to compete and what they can get. We came out about a month ago with, a common sense, achievable plan based on work that's been done in red states and blue states for making 2 years of community college tuition free to any Pennsylvanian who wants to go on to some form of higher education or needs to re-equip themselves in midstream. And then the final thing I want to say is that I'm proud of how we've radically changed investing what we do at Treasury. I have waged a similar fight to change how we invested our two pension funds. I uncovered nearly $4 billion in hidden costs. I've got them to adopt for the first time a ban on travel paid for by managers. I've focused like a laser on fees. I outlined in a commission a way to save nearly $10 billion that would go to the bottom line and relieve taxpayers and beneficiaries. But that work is far from complete. It's further along at one of our funds than another. But I want to keep taking on Wall Street, and I want to keep taking on what they're doing to the pensions in our state.
I want to talk about the first two things that you mentioned, the retirement fund and also free community college for Pennsylvanians. With the pension, okay, maybe I shouldn't call it a pension fund, the 401k, portable 401k, yeah. Would there be state money used in that?
No. There would be a modest amount of state money that would be a loan for startup costs. But the model is it would be exactly like our 529 program, which doesn't cost the state any money to maintain. It's funded. The expenses are paid for out of a small portion of the contributions. So there would be no state funds, you know, subsidizing this. The idea is that we know from, you know, human nature that if you don't have a way of saving for retirement where you work and it's not automatic, you're not going to do it. I worked for myself. I was in business for myself for about 7 years, and only two of those years did I do it, and I think I'm pretty financially sophisticated. But if you give, as some states have recently started to do, if you give these folks at work a way to automatically deduct contributions from their paycheck, even of small amounts, you can put them on a path to retirement security. There's no employer contribution. There's no state contribution. There's simply a state-facilitated program, again, much like 529, so that we facilitate, but the private sector runs. I mean, we don't pick the, you know, we're not picking stocks for people's 529s. We turn around and contract. In that case, we did it with Vanguard. So it really is one of these programs that we ought to be able to come together on, even in the middle of COVID and even in dealing with everything we have to do. I would note, I love my state and I'm proud of my state, but I want to tell everyone, Colorado, in the middle of a pandemic, managed to pass this program, not because they said, well, we'll get to this when the pandemic's over, but for exactly the reason we should, which is the pandemic has revealed how desperately we need to work on problems like this. So there's no better time than the present.
As far as the 2 years of community college and job training program, there would be state money used there. And the question I have to ask is, you've described it yourself as fiscal condition of Pennsylvania during the pandemic. Where does the money come from? How can we afford this? I think we're talking about $82 million, if I remember correctly.
Yep. Yep.
Where does the money come from to start this during this? Well, let's face it, we're in a recession.
Yep. So, I mean, I'm going to give you a couple of answers, but one is that if we're talking about an investment of 80-some million dollars, that will raise the level of post-secondary education in the state, which has all kinds of economic implications for how much we prosper and therefore what our tax revenues are in the future. That's an investment that, if you're asking me, is worth making. Having said that, there are all kinds of ways to do this. So one state did it by simply repurposing existing federal funds that are now going to a variety of, you know, less effective programs in a less consolidated way, and saying, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do something dramatic and meaningful with it. By the way, the origin of this idea comes from the fiscally conservative state of Tennessee and happened on the watch of a Republican governor, Republican legislature, and advocated most prominently by the business community for exactly my first reason, that when you raise, we're helping Pennsylvanians, but we're also helping Pennsylvania. So there are different ways to do that we can find money even in this time. We've seen in the pandemic, by the way, some states have said, we think it's a perfectly legitimate use of COVID relief money to dedicate some of it to doing this, because one of the costs of COVID has been so many Pennsylvanians have found their work lives irrevocably changed, and so many Pennsylvanians, like people around the country, need to find ways to get themselves back in the game, and our job as a state should be to help them find ways to do that. So, yeah, there's a challenge, but Scott, the theme of I said we could do Keystones without spending any general fund money, and we did. I have a plan for retirement security that doesn't spend any general fund money, and I think we can get that done. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. In this case, I think there are different ways to do it. That should not be. And I know your job is to ask the questions, my job is to answer them, but that shouldn't be our first question in Pennsylvania, as a state where so many communities have been so devastated, so many families have been left behind by the skyrocketing cost of higher education. And as a state, we're not even close to the levels of our neighbors who are our competitors economically. Our first question should be, how do we give every Pennsylvanian what they ought to have, which is a fair shot at 2 years of a degree that'll help them get employed or reemployed.
The biggest criticism from your Republican opponent is that you have your sights set on higher office, like running for governor in 2 years or the U.S. Senate in 2 years. Are you planning to run for higher office?
I didn't know I had a criticism from my opponent, Scott. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. Look, I am running. I think this is the election of our lifetime, for obvious reasons. I am focused on this election, and I don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not looking around corners. This issue came up when I first ran 4 years ago. It was silly then, and it's silly now. I ran for state treasurer. I wasn't running because I saw it as a way station. I ran for it because I wanted to do this job. I think I have done it very well. I'm going to keep fighting to do it very well for Pennsylvania. I'm running for re-election because I want to keep doing what I've been doing, which is bringing integrity back to government, standing up to Wall Street, and helping Pennsylvanians get ahead.
So that's not a no.
I'm focused on this election. I'm not thinking about an election that is years away, and I'm running for this job because I want to do this job, period.
Joe Tursella is the Democratic incumbent treasurer in Pennsylvania. Treasurer Tursella, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Always good to talk.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein & Lear.
A death in the family is devastating. A COVID-19 death has had a great impact on families, according to research. I think we all probably know that even without the research. But in a study of kinship networks in the U.S., Penn State University researchers found that approximately 9 surviving close family members will be affected by each death from the virus in the United States. Joining us today to talk about this research is Dr. Ashton Verdery, who is Associate Professor of Sociology, Demography, and Social Data Analytics at Penn State. Dr. Verdery, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, we are live. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Verdery, I said that, when we hear that 9 people are impacted by a COVID-19 death, many people probably would hear that and think, well, yeah, that makes sense. I can count the number of people in my own family that would be impacted. So what was the idea behind this research?
Well, we started the project just trying to get a sense of how broadly spread these deaths might be felt. Early on, there was a bit of a narrative about nursing home kind of related deaths, and that these were kind of older adults who kind of lacked integration in the community. And we wanted to get a sense of, given the age profiles, how many other people they might be affecting. And so we undertook this computational study to try and estimate that.
When you say the age profiles, why does that make a difference, and especially in the COVID-19 case?
So COVID-19 mortality is highly age-graded in the United States and actually everywhere in the world, where the risks of death are substantially higher among 80-year-olds than they are among 70-year-olds, than they are among 60-year-olds. That, of course, doesn't account for all the other kind of health complications that arise from it, but the risks of death tend to be super age-graded. And so we were interested in using that pattern to try and understand who might be left behind by this particular mortality crisis.
Now, your research found that 9 people, about 9 people, I mean, it's actually broken down a little bit more specifically, about 9 people will be impacted. Impacted in what way?
So we, because, the data is not available yet to estimate that directly, we were just able to look at the type of relationship people have to the expected deaths that would occur. And that's where we came up with this number that each expected death would produce 9 people kind of being bereaved. In terms of impact, we know from other studies very clearly that there are substantial mortality risks after experiencing family bereavement. For instance, we know about the dying of a broken heart kind of syndrome that often happens to widows and widowers. But also there are additional kind of psychological and other processes that affect people's well-being, including like 30% of people who experience recent bereavement go on to develop psychological conditions related to complicated grief and other complexities.
So if that be the case, what does it say? How can this research information, this data, be used?
I think the current use right now is to what we came up with is what we call a bereavement multiplier, which is sort of an expected number of people who would be lost for each death. And so I think the most useful thing right now is to use that multiplier to try and understand particular types of impact. For instance, we're working on a current study trying to estimate the impacts of children who have lost a parent in the United States on the basis of this. And even though most of the deaths tend to be people in their, you know, over the age of 50 or 60 who might not have small children under 18 at this point, we're actually finding a kind of a, just given the staggering size of the mortality shock in the U.S. arising from the crisis, that there's a large number of children that are expected to lose a parent from COVID-19 mortality.
Even though the majority, the great majority of people who have died because of COVID-19, didn't your research find that there are some younger people that have been affected as well? I mean, people in their losing spouses at younger ages other than, say, in their late 70s or 80s, correct?
That is correct, yes, and parents and other types. As Treasurer Torsello was noting earlier, you know, a lot of people are out of work and other things like that right now, and often we turn to relatives to help us kind of make ends meet in those circumstances. And, you know, these deaths from COVID-19 mortality are eroding some of those pillars of social support in the community. For instance, lots of children live with their grandparents, you know, during childhood. About half of minority youth in the U.S. at some point before age 18 live with grandparents. And so there's the loss of those relatives really might erode some of the kind of stable sources of ways that people get through not just a mortality crisis, but economic crises that are kind of being spawned by this as well.
And you also talk about how at the federal level, this may inform officials about extensions for family and medical leave, correct?
Yes, I do think that's an important implication, as is kind of attention to particularly vulnerable populations that might lose individuals, including people like children who are in elementary school who maybe lose their home because their grandparents passed away or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little more specifically, if you would, about what impact this could have on family leave.
On family leave, I think that we need to be, you know, from both the employer side of things as well as from a policy side of things, be attuned to the fact that this is going to be a substantial kind of new mortality crisis in the U.S. You know, excess death estimates are suggesting that this is going to be a particularly severe year in terms of dying. So I think from like employer perspectives and kind of company perspectives, it's useful to keep in mind that, you know, bereavement-related policies might be heavily used this year, vacation time and things like that, in order to have productive workforces. And from a policy side of things, I think we need attention to kind of ways to understand you know, how to advance people's lives during these circumstances.
And I don't know whether you looked at this or not, but, you know, let's face it, the workplace has changed a whole lot for many, many people in this state and across the country due to this pandemic. Are there, I mean, we have employers that, businesses, employers out there that are struggling to survive. Are they looking at how this impact, the death of a loved one in a family, can impact their workers, and are they making any changes?
So I'm not aware of, you know, policy changes being pursued by specific companies, but I do think that these are kind of potentially existential issues for them. There's a you know, short term crisis of someone being out, and how do you kind of replace their labor while they're gone in this particularly difficult time for being a successful company. And then there's the longer term kind of drag on productivity issues that might arise from people experiencing long-term psychological kind of impacts from this or other kinds of instability. And so I think that both sides of it deserve attention. And there certainly is room for potential policy intervention to support companies that are going through these kind of crises.
The research also found that there is a difference. It may be slight, but there is a difference between white and African Americans. What is that difference?
Yes. So we found essentially two forms of difference. The first form of difference is we do find slightly higher multipliers among African American individuals than white individuals, non-Hispanic white individuals, which means that, for each death, say, the bereavement multiplier for whites is about 8.7. For Black Americans, it's like 9.1. So there's, they're both about 9, but it's slightly higher for Black Americans. But the second form of difference is there's been such a staggering disparity in the death rates that we would expect that, much larger proportion of the Black population is experiencing these bereavement related challenges than the white population, just because of the scale of inequality in race differences in death.
So I also understand, and I want to don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, that in the future that you're planning to look at morbidity in opioid cases, or mortality, I should say, in opioid cases. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, we're working on a host of things, and the opioid crisis is one of those that we're currently focused on with this project. It's going to be a different type of bereavement that happens. Many people who use opioids and overdose and pass away, tend to be kind of younger than, but certainly a much younger age profile than the COVID-19 mortality profile. And so we're trying to understand, who those individuals might leave behind. A kind of staggering number of them probably have infants and toddlers. Many of them will leave parents bereaved. And so we're trying to quantify those types of losses to better understand the reverberating crisis, the reverberating opioid crisis in people's lives.
You said that, and I think, again, it's one of those things that probably most people understand right off the bat, is that 2020 will be a year when this country and really around the world, worldwide, that we will be experiencing many more deaths than expected. As someone who studies demography, what does that mean? Well, I mean, just give us a sense of why. I mean, obviously, it's noteworthy in that we have grieving families, we have people suffering. But as a demographer, when we have a year where there are more than 200,000 more deaths than expected, what does that mean?
So it's a real, crisis in terms of, historically unprecedented. It tends to be that when you adjust for kind of the population getting a little bit older, the number of deaths tend to decline from year to year. We sort of see this general progress in terms of kind of battling back these diseases that kill us. And this one has really kind of reversed that for a few years. The idea of an excess mortality is if we take, say, the average numbers of people who die in a year from, say, 2015 to 2018, when the data is most current, and we can really compare how many people have died this year against that level. And we're seeing, I saw recently that the estimate is, 260,000 excess deaths, even more than the number attributed directly to COVID.
Dr. Ashton Verdery, who is Associate Professor of Sociology, Demography, and Social Data Analytics at Penn State, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
With information overwhelming social media users, it's important for media organizations to ensure their listeners, viewers, readers can trust their reporting. There are questions like, how do people decide what news is trustworthy? Or how can journalists influence what users consume and share? Those questions have come up repeatedly at public forums that WITF journalists have participated in. WITF is taking part in the Trusting News Project. We've talked about this fairly often over the last year or so. Joining us today is WITF's Multimedia News Director, Tim Lambert. Tim, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
So Trusting News, let's just remind the listeners what Trusting News, what the project is.
Sure. This is a program we've been a part of for about 4 years now. I serve as one of four national coaches. So the Trusting News Project basically talks to media organizations about ways they can gain credibility, they can regain trust with their audience members, their listeners, their viewers, their readers, with tools to identify disinformation, fact check, being a little bit more transparent in how they go about telling stories, finding different perspectives, and being transparent about their pursuit for different perspectives in to include in their stories as well. So there's a lot of different tools that media organizations can use to help the audience understand the action of journalism a little better.
With 2 weeks to go before the November 3rd election, of course, many, many people have voted already or are planning to vote via mail before November 3rd. But especially right now, it is very important for news consumers to be able to know the news that they are consuming is trusted. How's WITF approaching the election?
One of the things that we've decided to focus on in the run-up to the election, and we have really going back to the primary, which was delayed due to the coronavirus pandemic, is to take a look at the process of voting. I think a lot of questions have arisen over the process in Pennsylvania of casting ballots, of mail-in balloting. Is it safe to vote in person? So we have our reporters looking at questions that may be on the minds of voters in Pennsylvania, in central Pennsylvania, such as who can be a poll watcher and what exactly does a poll watcher do? Taking a look at the deadlines for mail-in balloting, explaining how naked ballots work, taking a look at what the state legislature is or isn't doing to make voting easier in Pennsylvania amid the coronavirus pandemic. So there's a lot of different steps we're taking to make sure that our audience is well-informed when they make that ultimate act of being a part of the community, that act of citizenship in casting a ballot.
As you well know, and I sure that so many of our listeners are aware of, one of the things that has contributed to the polarization of the country nowadays is that so many news consumers tend to go toward a media where, you know, they hear what they want to hear. They kind of hear views that reinforce their own. So that being said, for someone who is not a WITF listener on a regular basis, someone who just tunes in, wants to find out about the process or get election results, what do you say to that person that, you know, here's why you can trust the news that you're hearing on WITF?
Well, I think we have a pretty rigorous editing process with myself and Scott Blanchard that go over our reporters' stories. But our reporters are in the community. They're on the ground. They have an understanding of the issues impacting central Pennsylvania. They live here. They're a part of the community. And I think that's important. It's not, looking, just scanning the wire and then rewriting a story. And then, you know, some organizations would do that don't follow journalistic standards. They'll put their opinion in it and tell you what to think. And our stories, we do not tell you what to think. They're rigorously reported. Reporters are talking to sources in person. Even in the pandemic, we're finding ways to reach out to talking to people who are voting, elections officials, county commissioners, state lawmakers. So I think we follow the journalistic standards, which again, in the spirit of trusting news, those standards, those guidelines are available at WITF.org, and you can see for yourself what we follow when we go through the editorial process.
One of the keys to trusting news is transparency. How has WITF used that transparency in how we put together our stories?
One of the things that we're doing right now for the election is asking people to be patient with the results. I think there is a lot of confusion and concern about what happens on the when the polls close, and some results are from in-person voting, but a lot of ballots still remain to be counted. So I think what we're doing is we're putting a little note in each story that we have to produce on the election about reminding people just to be patient with the results, that there likely won't be known who the winner is for a few days, and the counting of ballots will continue after election night, as it does most years. As we saw with the primary in June, there were a number of candidates who did not know whether they had won or not for at least a week in some cases. And none of those candidates went out and declared themselves the winner. They were patient, and that is something that happens every year in an election. So if a candidate does call for the counting to end and for themselves to be declared the winner, we want to remind people that winners will be decided when all the votes are counted, and that's how the American election system works. And our approach on election night is going to be, again, focusing on the process of voting. We will be reporting those partial results that are coming in from in-person voting when the polls close. But most importantly, we are going to have reporters across the region that are going to be focusing on any issues that pop up. Are there going to be any instances of voter intimidation? Are there going to be problems with some of the voting machines? Are there long lines that are holding people up from voting? Are there issues where someone isn't allowed to vote? So there are a lot of things that we will be keeping an eye on, and especially I think this year with so much focus on the voting process, a lot of people may see something they think is wrong, but it's something that could be a simple mistake or something that happens each and every election where bureaucracy gets in the way and there's just a mix-up of some sort, so there won't be a grand conspiracy behind it. Unless, of course, we find out there is. But we will be looking into that, and we will be talking to listeners and talking to you throughout the day on Election Day to let you know how the voting process is going in central Pennsylvania.
I want to get back to that in just a moment, but we have a question here from a listener. Many conservative people believe that the media are personally progressive and therefore advocates for liberal candidates. How does the process build confidence in voters to trust that they are representing the most neutral perspective?
Well, I think that we present facts in our stories. I think it's strange to think that if you don't know the reporter personally. So that's always a strange question when people think that reporters are liberal or there's a liberal bent or a conservative bent or whatever. I mean, we've tried to report on the facts. We provide the proper context to each story, and it's a rigorous voting process. So say in an instance that there is a reporter out there that is biased and submits a story to me for editing, I will catch that bias. Or if I don't, the next editor, Scott Blanchard, will. So there are multiple eyes that are on each and every reporter that post a story, multiple eyes that go through the stories and make sure that each story is factual, each story has the proper context to it. That would be my answer for that.
I want to follow up a little bit on that. And a lot of this, Tim, goes to kind of like journalism 101. But I've seen a number of opinion pieces here recently that have talked about media coverage of the 2016 presidential election. And, you know, one of the things that we as journalists over the years have tried to do is to strike a balance that, if we report something that is, negative toward one side or, even positive, that we talk to someone else who may have a different opinion. That's not going to stop, and that will continue. But the criticisms I've seen have talked specifically about 2016 and how, for example, Hillary Clinton's emails were put on the same level, reported every time that there would be a bombshell about the Trump campaign, and that these opinions are that the media should not be covering these things. Like, it's not a 50-50 tit for tat kind of thing that we have to state, even though people may think that it sounds biased. There has to be stating of facts in the story. How do you see that?
Well, I think you said it right there. I mean, we follow the facts. We follow the documents. We follow what our sources are telling us, and then we recheck what those sources say. I mean, when you look back at 2016, I think what's changed for us this year is we're making an effort to get out and talk to voters in communities. In 2016, you saw a lot of stories about coal miners in Pennsylvania think this, suburban housewives think this voting bloc thinks that. What we've done is through the America Amplified National Reporting Project, which focuses on community engagement, we've spread reporters across Pennsylvania, across central Pennsylvania as well, to talk to voters, not necessarily to hear that they're going to vote for President Trump or Joe Biden, but what issues matter to them? What are they paying attention to each and every day? Because they can't, you know, spend the time and effort to be a news junkie and follow every single tweet that goes out by everybody in the world or follow every breaking news story. There are, you know, people who are dealing with the coronavirus. There are people dealing with issues that where they've lost their jobs, where their businesses have been closed and have reopened and the business is slow to return. There's schools, there's parents struggling with working from home and dealing with their kids with online classes, and maybe 2 days a week they're going in person. So there's a lot of issues out there that have occupied people's time. And I think getting out and talking to people like we have been with the work of Emily Previty and Sam Dunklaw and Alana Elder and Anthony Orozco and Brett Schultes and Rachel McDevitt, talking to people in communities and finding out what is on their minds. It's not about the horse race, which I think is the lesson we've learned from 2016. We want to hear what people actually think about issues and what they think can be done to solve those issues in their community.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've touched on a lot of this already, but how do you think this year is going to be different than past elections?
I think just because we won't have the results, I think it's a brand new ball game. And I think you also have a president who has cast doubt on mail-in balloting. He has cast doubt on whether he will accept the results. So we are kind of in an unknown, and we're you know, going day by day to see what happens next. But, you know, what happens if there are going to be efforts of armed intimidation at the polling places? We will report on that. What happens if there are results on election night that look like they're pretty close to being a blowout in either side, for either side? We will report on that. So I think there's just a lot of planning that we're trying to look at all the different scenarios to see exactly how things will shape up on election night. So really, going into this, this is probably one of the most an election that just has so many unknowns that I've ever experienced in my career, and I've been doing this, geez, almost 30 years now.
Well, you see, that's just it. I think that, you know, the word unprecedented is tossed around a lot during 2020, but it certainly fits in this case that we are looking at an unprecedented election. I saw that Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro appeared on CNN, and he said he thought that we would have results or would know who has won the presidential race in Pennsylvania by the next morning. Now, that is probably one of the more optimistic views that I have heard, and I'm not going to disagree or agree with the Attorney General, but that's one of the first people I've heard say that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's 2020. Anything can happen. I mean, at this point, nothing that happens in 2020 will surprise me. But we also have to be, again, like I said, look at all the scenarios that may play out. Maybe there will be results on November 3rd, and maybe President Trump will be reelected, or Joe Biden will claim Pennsylvania on that night. Or maybe we'll have to go through a long recount, or not a recount, but counting of the ballots with lawsuits flying here and there. So, and, you know, Pennsylvania is the state. I don't think the president can afford to lose Pennsylvania. So as you've seen with Vice President Mike Pence visiting the mid-state twice in the last 3 days, they are putting a premium on their base here in Pennsylvania to turn out the vote and get people to vote. The president's going to be in Erie, another key part of the state today. So, you know, I throw all predictions out the window when it comes to anything that happens in 2020 at this point.
I'm right there with you.
I can't even speculate. Yeah.
No. Well, Tim, we're going to be doing this on Tuesdays, talking about, you know, updating this situation all the way through Election Day, maybe even past, and if there is a drawn-out count or something like that. So we'll get to talk about some other issues coming up on Tuesdays. But I want to thank you for joining us and, you know, explaining something that I know a lot of times people make judgments about the media and journalists. Well, here's a good opportunity to hear about how we do our jobs and what we present to you. Tim Lambert, WITF's Morning Meeting News Director, thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
Coming up tomorrow, we will have two candidates, Stacey Garrity, Republican running for state treasurer, Sarah Hammond running for Congress, the U.S. House of Representatives in the 11th Congressional District. She's a Democrat. That's coming up on tomorrow's program.